Good morning, folks. These monthly meetings are something that Chance Oberstein and I do as a service, really a community service to this community of registrants and their loved ones, because we know that folks have a lot of questions about what's going on out in the universe. And Chance and I do our best to help you navigate through what's really a minefield of laws, regulations, and policies. We really want you to avoid the minefield. So of course that you don't return to custody. So that's why we're here on Saturday mornings. We're going to do something slightly different this morning in case you're a veteran and you've come to these meetings before. We're doing something different. And so what we're doing different is we're starting a program called Meet the Board Members. So AXOL does have a board of directors. There are 11 board members, and Chance and I are two of the 11 board members, but there's nine you probably haven't met yet, or you may not have met yet. So we want you to meet them and really understand, you know, who's here behind the scenes to support you. And that's what we're all about, by the way. We're here to support you. So we do that in a variety of ways. And Mona, if you could silence yourself, that would be great. I'm trying to find her. I'm trying to multitask her, folks. I'm not sure I'm doing a good job of it. I'm trying to mute Mona, but maybe she muted herself now. So back to the Alliance and the fact that we have something, a new feature really here in the monthly meetings, and that's to meet the board members themselves. So in case you don't already know, I think we have six attorneys on the board of directors for the Alliance. That always makes things interesting. There's an old joke out there about a town that can't afford one attorney can always afford two. Because once the first attorney sues somebody, then there needs to be a second attorney in town, right, to represent the other party. So anyway, we have some very spirited debates in our Alliance board meetings, and we have a heck of a lot of brain power. And more important than that, even a lot of people care. They care about the registrants. They care about the registry. They care about family members. And again, that's really why we're here, folks. We're here to support you. And we're here to give you hope, because I know for some people, they think that the solution to the problem is, in fact, to hide in their fill in the blank, their room, their house, their garden, wherever. And unfortunately, when you hide, that doesn't stop the legislature or this, you know, your city government or any other form of government from passing a new law, establishing a new policy. So again, we're here to share information. And by the way, it is meant to be a two-way form of communication. And so at different times, we will ask you to raise your hand if you have a question or may have a comment. And if you have a spontaneous question or comment, go ahead and raise your hand anyway, and we'll try to fit in. Okay, so we have about 45 people so far, and they're coming. I think maybe, I don't think I actually introduced myself. I'm Janice Bellucci. I am the executive director of the Alliance. I'm also the founder of the organization, and I'm also a civil rights attorney. And joining me is criminal defense attorney Chance Oberstein, who in fact is president of the board. Chance, would you like to say something this morning?
Yeah, just good morning. Good morning. Nice to see you all here. And let's get started.
Excellent. Excellent. So a reminder here, this meeting is being recorded, and today it's being recorded in two different ways. It's being recorded, the audio and the video is being recorded, just like if you had, you know, a movie camera on. But there's another way that's kind of new, and that is a transcription. So it was requested by somebody who's on this call or this meeting to have a live transcript. So we do have a live transcript going. It's at the bottom of the screen, and I'm trying not to look at it because it's not a good idea to look at what you just said. It certainly interrupts my train of thought. So again, for those of you who have just joined in the last few minutes, I wanted to let you know again, we're doing something new today in that we're having a board member take some time today to introduce himself to us, explain a little bit about his situation, and also, you know, how he in fact supports this good cause. And he does it every single day. And I'm very happy that Roger's part of our team. So We'll save the rest of your introduction for a little bit later, Roger, but about 10:30, we'll ask Roger to speak. What some of you may not know is there's actually two organizations. So we have the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws, and we're really the public arm of this movement here. And what do I mean by that? We're the ones that do the lobbying in our state capitol, and someday we'll get to D.C. and do some lobbying in D.C., and we also are the ones, we educate in different ways, including having, can I call them protests? And we've had two protests so far. One was in Los Angeles County in the city of Carson because we had sued the city of Carson. They had presence restrictions and they wouldn't repeal them. And even with the lawsuit. So we had a protest there and that nudged them forward to do the right thing. We also had a second protest that was outside of a federal district court, and that was in Oakland when we challenged the International Megan's Law. So that's kind of the education arm of what we do. And then we also get involved in litigation from time to time. So, but in addition to the Alliance, there's another organization, and it's called the Family Safety Foundation, which is a very boring name, and we chose it to be very boring. You don't hear about the Family Safety Foundation much, and that's by design. Basically, the Family Safety Foundation is a foundation, and it looks at things from a broader perspective, you know, as most foundations do. And quite frankly, it supports most of the litigation. So those are the two organizations. So when I talk about board members, it's possible that you will meet a member of the Alliance board, or you might meet a member of the foundation board. And in fact, Roger, who's with us today, and we'll be speaking in a little while here. He started out on the Alliance board and now he's currently on the foundation board. So does anybody have any questions, I guess, about the organization? We've been around, actually the Alliance will celebrate our 12th birthday next month. So maybe we need a birthday cake chance.
That would be a good idea. That'd be a nice idea. Yeah.
A virtual birthday cake with 12 candles on it. And I'm, you know, I'm very proud of the organization. We've achieved a lot over the 12 years. We really have. And I still remember in the very beginning, not knowing how to solve all the problems that registrants face. And it was a very daunting challenge, quite frankly. And, you know, it's like, where do you start? There's this huge, huge issue, this minefield really. And where do you start? So, the board, and that's where having a board of directors is very valuable, because we talked about it and we said, well, let's pick the lowest hanging fruit. And I don't know if you all are familiar with that expression or not, but if you've ever picked fruit from a tree, of course, the easiest fruit to reach is the lowest hanging fruit. So whether it's an orange or an apple tree or anything else, the fact is you want to reach up and just grab a piece of fruit and eat it. The lowest hanging fruit is certainly the easiest to get to. We're past the lowest hanging fruit, though. So after 100 lawsuits, most of them here in California, we're past low-hanging fruit and we're reaching up farther up the tree. And so when I start talking about some of the litigation, and Chance as well talks about that, you know, what we're going to talk about is we've got a lot of pending cases right now. And we're waiting for decisions. Like in one particular case, we filed our final brief in April. And 4 months later, we still don't have the court's decision. And that's an appellate court decision. So, guess what? The courts give attorneys a lot of deadlines. They don't give themselves deadlines. So a lot of times you're waiting for the judge to make a decision. And there's no good way to nudge a judge, at least that I found. Maybe Chance has a better idea about that.
No, not really. Not really. Don't want to nudge a judge. Want them to come to their own conclusions.
You know, I think that could be a Dr. Seuss book, How to Nudge a Judge.
Yeah.
At least it rhymes. Okay. You can tell I'm kind of in a silly mood this morning. Oh, we have a hand up. Michael, please unmute yourself.
Morning.
Good morning.
So I've got a couple of things going on. One, I just got my DOD car released so that I can go on base now.
Fabulous. And what state is that in, Michael?
Georgia. Fort Stewart. But we're traveling across country right now, and we stopped at Tinker Air Base, and they scanned my card there, and I was allowed to go on there as well.
And Tinker is in Oklahoma, I think?
Correct, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
Okay.
So they when I had it done, what had happened was that I had gotten a letter for Halloween from my jurisdiction over there, Liberty County in Georgia, which stated that they want us to go down and pick a poster up and put it on our front door very prominently for everybody to see. So the
what kind of poster, Michael?
They described it as one that basically that that it's a sex offender that lives at the home, and that trick-or-treaters should beware.
Was this on base, Michael?
No. I'm off base, and this is, I'll get to that as well. I'm directly off base, and I'm controlled by the county sheriffs over there. And so I called the registering officer over there, and I asked her what that was about. And she stated that that's what they want all the registrants to do now, is to put things. And I proceeded to request if it was a regulation, that's a new regulation that I didn't know about or anything like that, because I was off paper. So, you know, I wasn't subject to the probation or parole regulations, because incidentally, they make them go to a meeting on Halloween night for anybody on paper there. You have to go between 5 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. During Halloween in Georgia.
Do you live in Butts County by chance?
No, I'm in Liberty. Butts County is above Atlanta. I'm okay. Down by Savannah.
Well, the reason I asked that question is there was an attorney who successfully challenged the Halloween signs in Butts County. Are you aware of that?
Yes, I am. Yes, I recall that from last time we were talking. So in the conversation, I had mentioned to her the whole thing about me getting pulled off to the side and said I had a bolo on me and then getting handcuffed at the main gate over the situation, and she informed me that she knew about the regulation that was coming into effect, but as she was told by them, it was simply to remove registrants from living on base, which they can't do per the military regulations themselves. Registrants are allowed to live on base so long as it's approved by the commander. Except for active duty military, which my wife is active duty, so we have rights no matter what to live on base. And that was always the question, do we live on base, when I got denied? So fast forward here, I let her know that I was leaving state for a couple of weeks, and I asked her, I said, by the way, did you make any calls after I spoke to you about this? And she said, oh yeah, she called over there, because apparently there was a couple more people that had got pulled over on bolos. And like no more than an hour after I talked to her, I get a call from the Department of Emergency Services, the guards that handle all the bases, and the guy tells me to come in and have my card reactivated.
That's great news. Wow, thank you for sharing that, Michael. Thank you.
So yeah, and what I did originally was because my wife just had a baby. It was a month and a half ago.
We were
trying to get to where my card was cleared, so that because she has to give birth on base at the hospital there. And we kept asking them, said, you know, what are we going to be doing for that when she goes into labor and me needing to drive her on base?
Sure.
Because it's.
The driver
scanned at our base, because
okay.
they enacted trusted traveler over here at our base, which means that if it's a service member or DOD card holder, the passengers don't have to show their IDs to go on base, no matter what. But Tinker, incidentally, they everybody gets scanned. But anyways, we put in a request for a waiver packet, and they have been blowing us off for that for all this time, waiting on that. So it's just, I find it really coincidental that all of a sudden that, you know, once I brought the registering office from the, you know, the sheriffs, that they all of a sudden call me up and give me my pass.
Well, I really... I really appreciate that data point. Folks, if you're not speaking, would you please mute yourself? We're hearing some background noise from somebody. I'm sorry. So thank you again, Michael, for sharing that with us, and it gives me some hope. Thank you. Bruce, I know that you are waiting to speak. Would you please, there you go, unmute yourself.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
This question is for Chance. He's talked in the past about this concept of having coffee, which is intriguing to me. So let me kind of explain. I want to go to Kansas, where you're allowed to visit for no more than 3 days before as a visitor, before you have to register. So if I want to stay longer than 3 days, I can go to Kansas City, which is where I'm going. Missouri, the Missouri state line is literally 10 minutes away. So let's say I stay in Kansas City, Kansas for like 2.5 days, drive over to Missouri, have coffee, as he's described it, or I don't know, go to a Walmart, and then go back to Kansas. Does that mean my 3 day clock essentially starts over again? And can you pretty much do that wherever you go? If you're near a state line, what's to stop you from crossing that state line, having coffee, and then going back? And that a visitor registration requirement essentially would reset, if I understand it right, as he's described it.
Okay. So in brief, probably something that should be discussed individually and not within a meeting like this, but in general, you got to check the jurisdiction's requirements. If you have to see whether or not there's an accumulation of days, so many days you can spend in any one jurisdiction anyway. But your answer, the short answer to that is every time you cross the state line and then reenter, it starts a new time clock. You know, the issue is not the new time clock. The issue is aggregate days you can spend in any one jurisdiction. But we'll get to that, I think, later when we discuss this thing. This domestic travel, I think, if we do.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I just like to emphasize something that Chance just said. Not in all jurisdictions, but I see your hand up, Paul. You'll be next. So not in all jurisdictions, but in some jurisdictions, they do have an aggregate limit as well. So, for example, in Hawaii, I believe you can visit Hawaii up to 10 days in a single trip. But the aggregate for the calendar year is 30 days, and there's some other aggregates out there. So be careful. It's not just per visit, but sometimes it is, you know, per calendar year. I think Florida is really a short fuse. I forget if it's 3 days or 2 days now, but I mean, that's per calendar year. And, I'm just going to go ahead and say, I remember one time helping somebody said, well, if you went there on December 30th, right, you could actually, or maybe it was December 29th, you could actually spend 2 days in 1 year and then 2 days in the next year, but then you couldn't go back, you know, after that. So, I mean, there are ways to do things that maybe we wouldn't otherwise do, but you have to be really, really careful because there's quite a potential penalty if you get it wrong. So thank you, Bruce, for that comment. Paul, you've had your hand up for a while. Would you go ahead, sir, on your question or comment? Paul, we can't hear you.
Okay. You can hear me now, can't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I just out of curiosity, it's not really very important, but I was interested in finding out the relationship, if any, between Narsol and Axel.
Well, that's a good question, Paul. We work together sometimes, not as often as maybe we could. But the fact is we're all part of this larger community, the community of registrants. And, in fact, we need to be able to work together collaboratively. Are you with Narsol, Paul?
I'm on their mailing list and I get a lot of information from them, and it was just my curiosity.
Yeah, I'm on their mailing list as well. And, I think they do a great job of sharing information. I'll just leave it at that. Michael, do you have another question or comment? Thank you, Paul.
Michael? My other thing I was wondering about is list of attorneys, because she brought up the registration officer brought up the fact that being that how long I've been in Georgia now, I'm eligible to be removed off of their registry. And then she also brought up that whether or not I should do, because California is my original offense state. Do I need to go and try and get removed from California as well?
So that answer, Michael, depends on Georgia law, not a California law. So I'll just cover it briefly, and Chance, I'm sure you'll have something to add to it. Each state makes their own laws with regard to who has to register and for how long. And so some states recognize when your conviction state removes you from the registry, but not all. So I'm just going to leave it that way. You really need to talk to attorneys in both states. Chance, do you want to add something there?
No, I think that's a comprehensive answer. That's how I would answer it, too.
Okay. Be careful, folks. And, you know, both Chance and I have been working with people in the petitioning process here in California, and we'll be talking about that in some greater detail shortly. But just because you are removed from the registry in California does not mean you don't have to register if you move to another state. So please listen to that. Just because you're removed from the registry in California does not mean you don't have to register in another state. It might mean that in a particular state, but it's also possible that it doesn't mean that. So you need to be extremely careful before you decide to move somewhere, and even before you decide to visit somewhere. It is possible that you will have to register in another state where you're visiting, even if you're no longer required to register in California. That's the sad news, but that's reality. And again, Chance and I wanted to help you avoid, danger and the possibility of returning to custody, if that's possible. Okay. Well, you know what? It's close enough to 10:30. There you are, Roger. It's close enough to 10:30. So let me go ahead and introduce our guest speaker today. His name is Roger Honeycutt. And Roger, if you would go ahead and unmute yourself. And I've known Roger probably close to 10 years now. Roger's been very active in both organizations, both the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws and also the Family Safety Foundation. He's been a member of both boards, and he's just been a valuable member and a very active participant. I know Roger just spent a lot of time up here in Sacramento lobbying, for example, and he helped to lobby in support of the tiered registry law. In part because it's passage, we can credit Roger with that because he was such a zealous advocate. So, Roger is on the registry himself. He is, as I said, currently on the foundation board. And, you wonder sometimes what's behind the scenes. I'm a lawyer. Chance is a lawyer. We don't know how to do things on websites. At least I don't. I shouldn't speak for you. Chance, maybe you do. But I don't. And Roger's a person who does. So when you comment on an article or something on the Axel website, Roger is the one, and there's one other person who also shares the responsibility, who actually reviews the comments before they ever get posted. And so we don't allow obscenity on our website, and we don't allow violence on our website. So, and if Roger ever has a question, he's really good about sending something to me and seeing what I think about if that's violent or if it's obscene. So, having said that, Roger, please take it away. And, again, I'm very pleased that Roger Honeycutt is able to join us today.
Thanks for the intro, Janice. Again, my name is Roger Honeycutt, and, I'm really proud to be a part of Axel. I'm a Tier 3 290 registrant. So, for now, I won't be able to get off the registry, but I want to fight for all of you, Tier 1s and 2s, okay, that you guys get off at some time too. Well, when I first paroled back in 1995, I remember how people had to drive to the police station and look at, I think it was like a DVD-ROM disc they would have to look at. And I think probably no one really did that. When I first got an apartment after I paroled, nobody said anything. They didn't even do a background check. My employment at the beginning, same thing. It just really wasn't an issue. When I got a job in the San Francisco Bay Area, nobody ever checked. It wasn't even an issue. Some of them didn't even ask for backgrounds, or were you arrested or anything. So it's pretty wide open for me. I got some housing in the Bay Area. It was part of a house that had been sealed off as a separate unit. And, again, no problem getting housing there. Even though she had children, I didn't even see them. It was like having an apartment with neighbors. It wasn't an issue. When I was hired at a major software company in 2000, it said on the application, were you convicted of a felony within the last 10 years? And I had just passed that point. So I truthfully said no. And so for many years, I went to company functions. I worked late, worked weekends, got to know the people, and, everything went fine until my manager said, we need to talk with you. Come on over to this conference room. I went in there and there were four levels of managers. And, they said, well, one of the employees saw you on this, new online Megan's website and told other people. And she said, he doesn't want you, at company functions or working late or working weekends because you might attack their children. And this is after 7 years, right? So, it kind of amazed me that this was an issue. They wanted me gone, I could tell. And the way that they did it was they kept dumping more and more and more work on me. And I had to keep doing more and more and more. And finally, I realized this isn't sustainable. And I would have to leave on my own terms. And my brother-in-law, coincidentally, he said, well, why don't you come down and work for me? You know, my IT stuff going down here. I thought, wow, that'll give me a break. That'll give me a break. I can rethink of where I wanted to help. Unfortunately, I lived in very bad housing down there. He hardly paid me anything. And even in that poor area, people still called up the landlord. Said, well, how could you allow him to live in this nice town? So after a few years of that, it was about 2009, the country was falling into a deep recession, and Jessica's Law had passed, and I know it had residency restrictions, and I thought, you know, the only way I have to buy my own place. I couldn't afford much, but housing had cratered into nothing. So I looked way out in Riverside in the desert area to get away from parks and children's care and all this other stuff. It was really, really difficult trying to find a place. Well, then I found out that Orange County, where I was working, they elected not to do that part of Jessica's Law. They didn't have that residency restriction. And so I could work in Orange. I could live in Orange County. Problem was trying to find housing because when I applied, no answer. And I pretty much knew why that was. Finally found, and the worst part of Orange County is a slum area in Santa Ana, and found a landlord who didn't ask me any of those questions. It was a real scummy building, but I was overjoyed to have a place to live. And so I was there for a couple of years. I didn't have any problems there, but I was facing a problem with employment because now applications have more and more questions like that. And I thought, you know, I really need to be freelance. So I was getting a certification in technical writing, aiming for that. Well, in previous years, when I went to register, it was pretty straightforward. I would walk into the police station at a designated time, registered, maybe took 30 minutes, and I left. While Santa Ana had different ideas on how they were going to get punitive, I had to schedule a time, certain time, only twice a week was available, and get in the area for up to an hour or 2 hours, then get in single file with the other people, put our hands behind our back, down, walking into the jail and in an elevator downstairs and then past all the cells with the inmates. looking at us, right? Like, we know why you're here. And then we get into the registration, and I had to strip down and put on the green jumper that the inmates, and they took a picture of that. Just amazingly difficult, trying to make life difficult. Well, I got a card from this organization I never heard of called California Sex Offense Laws, and I was like, whoa, what's this? And the way it was described was they were actually on my side. So I went up to Los Angeles, and it was Janice speaking to a room full of people, dozens of registrants. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't find registrants because I couldn't look on the website, but here they were. And what Janice said really filled me with hope, talking about how they were fighting for us, how they wanted us to have a chance and build better lives. I just kept going there, really thrilled. And then my mom got cancer, I was applying for a certification to be able to get off the registry. And so it was recommended to me that I go ahead and move up to Central California. That way I could take care of parents and hopefully get a certification. Well, certification didn't work out because of changes in the law. But being up here allowed me to easily get to Sacramento, where Axol was doing lobbying. And so ever since 2015, my eyes have been opened to the value of showing up, standing up, and speaking up. I remember we went to a California Sex Offender Management Board meeting years ago, and I sat next to a woman who was very angry. In fact, all the women next to her were angry, and they all had the same shirt. And when it came time for public comment, they were complaining how this sexually violent predator was moving down to their neighborhood in San Diego, and that needed to be stopped. And the board said, well, you're in the wrong place. You should go over to that organization down there and talk to them about it. So they sat down, and then came the chance for those of us in Axol to tell our story to the board. They said they hadn't really talked a whole lot to registrants. Their first chance. So I told them my story and how I'd done everything I could to keep from reoffending. And as I sat down, I was wondering, how is this woman going to react? Here's a registrant sitting next to her. Is she going to yell at me, stand up? And she didn't move. She just sat there. And then afterward, I was absolutely astonished when she turned to me and said, you know, I didn't think you guys could change. I did not. She said, in fact, my husband, he committed an offense of that nature. And I just thought there's no way. But hearing you guys, and you in particular, being willing to change, have a new way of living, said, that's amazing. I'm going to remember that. In fact, I'll tell others about that. So that really showed me the value. When you think, well, all these enemies are out there and they all hate us and they want, individual stories can change lives. I remember in the lobbying we did, it filled me with hope because, now we got to talk to the lawmakers about bad bills. And originally the idea of going there and being willing to stand up with the rest of Axol in front of a microphone and say, oh, my name is Roger Honeycutt from such and such, and I oppose this bill. I didn't think I could do it, but I did. The first time it was scary. The next time it was easier. I realized I didn't have to give a speech. They don't want us to give speeches. Janice gives the main overview for us. And seeing a long line of people standing up and opposing these bills against registrants amazed the lawmakers. Well, nobody else came here and opposed these. We thought we could just keep doing them forever, get brownie points with our constituents. But it really worked. For years, we've been able to kill just a ton of bad bills that would have made our lives miserable. I mean, as bad as you guys think we have it now, imagine if all those residency restrictions and presence restrictions and additional requirements and bill after bill after bill had passed without Axol being there, how would your lives be now? So it's just been an amazing encouragement to see the light in people's eyes, like being in a politician's office in Sacramento, talking to their head of staff, listening to our stories, and especially the women with children who went there and talked about how the laws are damaging families. It is such an encouragement. I just encourage you guys, if you're discouraged and you just feel like nothing can be done, take part when you get an action alert. Sign up for those action alerts on our website, emails. I send them out. And if it's, we say, write a letter, write it. Phone call, make the call. When we start going back to Sacramento again, show up, because the smiles I saw on people's faces after they had done this lobbying with us, I could just see everybody's filled with hope. And that's really what I want from all of you, is to feel the hope that Axol is trying to give you. It's not easy. Society definitely does not like us, but we are chipping away. And, you know, the presence and residency restrictions alone right there, I think that's worth all of us supporting Axol. We got some amazing stuff we're going to be doing in the future that Janice is going to talk about, and things that we're doing now. So I'd like to open it up if anybody has any questions for me.
Yeah, thank you, Roger, for sharing so much about your circumstances. I will say, you know, Roger, you brought up the situation about the city of Santa Ana, which is in Orange County in Southern California. And I remember when I was first approached by somebody who had to register there, it was somebody else, not you, but I didn't believe the story when they first told me. The story that they basically marched registrants into the jail. I was like, what? They take you into jail? And you're there for up to 4 hours. And during that time, you don't have any communication with the outside. They made you take and, you know, strip from the waist up, and you had to basically put a jail uniform on. It just sounded too incredible and incredibly stupid and unconscionable, really, that anybody would do that. But it was easy to check out the allegation because I went on the Meganzaw website and I typed in Santa Ana, and all the photos popped up, and about 90% of the people who lived in Santa Ana were wearing the same shirt. Right? And I'm like, huh? And so I remember calling up the city of Santa Ana and the city attorney's office and saying, you can't do this. This is, you know, false imprisonment. You can't be taking people away for 4 hours and basically throwing them in jail for 4 hours, you know, and they said, oh, well, the only reason we do that is because we only have a camera in the jail. And so we take the pictures every year. And so before I even had time to think, I just blurted out, well, we'll buy you a new camera if that's all it takes, right? But they said, oh, no, of course, you know, we don't want you to buy us a camera. And so we sued them instead. And guess what? We won. So yeah. It's situations like that. You know, nobody in Santa Ana anymore or anywhere else is going to jail just to go register. And again, it really was false imprisonment, and people were being kept in jail for up to 4 hours. And as Roger was saying, you know, the inmates are basically giving cat calls because they know why you're there. And I'm sure people are calling you chomo and other, you know, things and stuff. And it's just not anything anybody should bear. And I will tell you, the latest report from Santa Ana is it takes 15 minutes to register, and all you do is walk up to the counter, sign some documents, and walk away. So thank you, Roger.
I also want to say something about Roger too, because I was able to see this firsthand because I'm the one who represented him when we went to court. And I want to say something really interesting about that, because it was at a time when the paradigm was in flux as far as the philosophy of the DAs go. We were in a certain district in a certain court. Another court was able to give feedback, and I'll never forget this. I walked into that court. Everybody, the DAs, the judge, everybody was pro Roger. That was the interesting part of it. And two district attorneys approached me, and they said a third one from another county had sent a file and wanted to be heard. And they said, we threw that in the trash can. We've already made up our mind. And what was wonderful about that was they were willing to accommodate based on this case called Tyree, which only lasted about 2 seconds in the universe. But for that case going back down, Roger wouldn't be registering today. It's really fascinating. What happened to Roger was he went from that position to the positions he's in today, which is he went from a position of feeling, where do I hide next to where do I go next? You know, to do whatever I need to do to help this community. And so, I'm really proud of Roger. I'm proud of his efforts. I'm proud of the time he's put in for the organization. And it's a real interesting and fascinating and compelling story about Roger's reformation and transformation to who he is today. And so, you know, these, funny as it may seem, little instances like that can change people forever. And I think it did so for Roger. And I hope it does so for all of you too, as you go along the same path and journey of doing the same thing, transforming. So good deal, Roger. I'm glad you spoke out.
Yeah, thank you again for joining us today. And we're going to go ahead and move on because I don't see any hands up. But again, it's great that you were here today, Roger, and you're our first board member to join us, for this new feature of the monthly meeting. And he won't be the last, because I think it's really important for you all to really know who's working on your behalf and working every single day. So thank you, Roger. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So let's talk about talk about courts. When we're talking about judges, oh my goodness, how to nudge a judge. Well, we could, if we only knew how, maybe we could do it with the SORNA regulations case, because I don't know how many of you are following this on our website or not, but we've had 5 different hearing dates for the SORNA regulation challenge. 5, right? The most recent date is September 12th. So I've worn out my welcome with Southwest Airlines, quite frankly, and how many times I've changed my flight down to Riverside. But it's because of this judge. And so he's changed the date 5 times. And of the 5 times, 3 of them have been at the request of the assistant U.S. attorney, and that she has not been available. But I really question is, like, how many assistant U.S. attorneys do you have in working for the federal government? And why is it that we're basing this all on one person's schedule? But so far, the judge has allowed that. And then in addition to her 3 requests for changes, the judge spontaneously has changed the hearing date 2. Now, people keep asking me, what does this mean? I'm an optimist by nature. I really am. Otherwise, I couldn't do this work, quite frankly. And for a while there, I was thinking that basically what the judge wanted to do, number one, was to make sure as few people were in the courtroom as possible. Okay, you keep changing the date and all the people with the good intentions to be there on a certain date, at some point in time, you just get worn out, right? And I mean, I'm hanging in there, but I know there are some people who intended to be there and to let me know, hey, I can't do it because of these changed dates, etc. The other is emptying the courtroom. Okay. And so what I mean by that, emptying the courtroom, I remember a case back when we did certificates of rehabilitation in California, not the petitioning process that we're doing now. One time I had a judge, who basically skipped over our case and kept going to the other cases. And my client is, right there in the courtroom with me. And at one point I said, look, I need to go to the restroom. I'll be right back. And he ran out of the courtroom, following me and said, what's going on here? Why did the judge skip my case? And I said to him, I want to be the first person to congratulate you. You're going to get your certificate of rehabilitation today. And he said, well, how do you know that? I said, because the judge is clearing courtroom. She wants as few people in the courtroom as possible when she grants your certificate. Okay. So back to this judge in the SORNA regulations case, maybe he's doing that and maybe he's not. I was thinking when he chose the Monday before the Labor Day holiday, and again, he doesn't want media attention, et cetera. I think there's a possibility he's going to rule in our favor, but he's afraid. That's a gut feeling that I have. I can't guarantee that's going to be the result. And then what happens if the judge does grant this motion? It's a motion for preliminary hearing, and it could stop the application of the SORNA regulations, which is a big deal. And I would imagine not a popular thing for a federal judge to do. Chance, do you have any feelings about this?
Well, you know, in practice for quite a while now, I can tell you that for judges, you know, and just in general in the system, fear is a blocker. What happens when someone's in fear is that it causes them to hesitate about doing the right thing. And in this case, he probably knows what the right thing is to do. I mean, it seems to be pretty obvious that, you know, the preliminary injunction is the right thing to do. And so I sense that hesitation here. I hope it doesn't compromise what he does, because this case is chilling out people who have already been removed from the registry and wish to now exercise their right to travel more than it is for people who are on the registry and are able to give 21 days notice and move freely. It's a really weird paradox. And so, but I think the right thing to do in this case would be to obviously grant the injunction. And so I'm hoping that's not the case. I'm hoping that this is just not a reflection of his hesitancy to do the right thing and therefore procrastinate because he's in fear of doing exactly what he knows is the right thing to do. That's just my supposition, my thinking.
All right, Chance, thank you for that. And folks, if you have a question or comment about the SORNA regulations, this would be a good time to raise your hand. I see one hand that's up, and I'll call on you in just a minute, Michael. But one of the things that I've wondered too, and I guess, well, is whether or not the judge plans to retire. If he thinks if he keeps pushing it out long enough, he can retire and never have to make a decision. I don't know. That's mere conjecture on my part. Michael, you have a question or comment about the SORNA regulations?
Yeah, there's kind of a weird statement about the SORNA regs.
Okay.
She made a comment that now they're saying that in past 72 hours from our jurisdiction, they want us to notify them.
You know, Michael, I can't hear you clearly. Something about 72 hours, what?
Yeah, they were saying that she said now they want 72-hour notification if I'm leaving from my home for more than 72 hours now.
That's not what the regulations say. I think the 72 hours has more to do with permanently moving. So if you move out of this jurisdiction and you're in a SORNA compliant state, I believe you have to give that 72 hours notice, but not if you're just planning to visit. However, the SORNA regulations do say if you're planning to leave your home residence for any reason for more than 7 days, you have to notify your registration office.
Yeah, that's what I did. I did what I did.
Okay, so the 7 day, just call it rule, the 7 day rule here under these new SORNA regulations. I mean, think about it. California is a big state, at least north and south. Okay. And many people will go to San Diego in Southern California, go to San Francisco in Northern California, and let's just say they live somewhere in between, right? But they don't ever give anybody any notice because they're in the same state, right? You're in the same state. But if California were a SORNA compliant state, which it is not, by the way, if it were a SORNA compliant state, then, and you were going to be gone from your residence for more than 7 days, you would have to notify your registration office. And folks, I swear the worst part about these SORNA regulations is the uncertainty of it. To whom do these regulations apply? We don't know. I mean, only 1/3 of the states in this nation are SORNA compliant. 1/3. And California is not a SORNA compliant state and has basically said thanks, no thanks for many years. So what the federal government did in these SORNA regulations is they really did a leapfrog over the state governments right to the registrants and said, okay, we don't care that your state of California is not SORNA compliant. You have to comply with these federal laws. And I don't think it's so. But remember what I said early on. Chance and I and others, we're here to help you navigate this minefield. And so I've said many times, out of an abundance of caution, please go ahead and give 21-day notice or longer, right, before you leave the country, even though California is not a SORNA compliant state, because we don't want you to be the test case, right, like poor Mr. Nichols way back when, who left the state of Kansas he thought permanently and moved to the Philippines. And, you know, the United States of America dragged him back from the Philippines and then took his case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, only to lose. The federal government lost that case, not Mr. Nichols. But what did they do to his life in the meantime, right? He thought he had moved to the Philippines, and instead he was dragged back to the United States and basically threatened with 10 years of federal prison. Chance,
yeah.
Anything you want to add there?
Well, that's what Janice is saying is true. It's not necessarily even the consequences. It's the process that's the killer. And, you know, the thing is that when you overreach and you leapfrog over the states as a federal entity and you point, you know, and you point at the individual, I mean, you got to ask yourself, okay, you know, what individual and, you know, who let me know this specifically? And, you know, do I, you know, there's a real aspect of notice here that has just been totally overlooked. Individuals we can't necessarily identify. And the fact that it's so blurred that all it does really is causes a freeze and confusion. And if you get caught up in the process, look, as much as everybody else is dazed and confused on one side, so are the others. And that leads to, you know, prosecutions that may or may not be viable, which leads to a process that's expensive and time consuming and compromising on the federal level. So we need to iron these things out. I mean, these things need to get resolved now, not later. And this is a big ticket item.
Yeah, I totally agree with Chance on that, folks. And one of the things that we hope that you will share with us is if your annual registration requirements change. Okay, so how could these SORNA regulations basically land in your lap? My best guess is it will be when you go to register annually. And then all of a sudden you'll read your registration requirements and they'll have changed dramatically. And let's just give, you know, I'll give you one really easy example. And that is under SORNA, some people are going to have to register 4 times a year. In California right now, nobody registers 4 times a year. Nobody. Okay. You might register every 30 days if you're homeless, but nobody registers 4 times a year. So what's going to happen if somebody in California goes to their registration office 3 months later, because that means you're registering every 3 months, right? And says, here, I'm here to register again. In California, the registration office says, get out of here. We don't do that, right? And you say, but the federal government says, I have to do this. So there's going to be a big war about this, a big legal battle about it, okay? And believe it or not, it kind of reminds me of what's going on within the law regarding marijuana, okay? It's like, what does registration and marijuana have to do with each other? It's only on the legal plane, folks. So what I mean by this is right now, many states, the possession of a certain amount of marijuana is totally legal. And yet the federal government says it's not legal. And so there's big battles going on in the courts between the federal government and the state governments. And gosh only knows who's going to win. And I don't care myself. I don't consume marijuana, but I'm, as a lawyer, I'm fascinated by what's going on in the courts. And I can just see that this is possibly what's going to happen with the SORNA regulations as well. You want to add anything there, Chance?
Well, I think there's also a financial component because those states with the largest populations can't afford to register people 3 or 4 times a year and do all the rest of what SORNA wants. So naturally, the states with the largest amount of registrants in it reject SORNA. And the ones with the least amount or a small amount of registrants in it need SORNA to implement what SORNA requires. And they get supplemented for it money-wise. So it comes down to a cost-benefit analysis. And that, you know, aside from everything else, is usually where the war typically starts. And, you know, where one state is resistant and another one isn't. It's not about ideology and it's not about the law in particular. It's about the ability to financially comply or not comply. And I think that has to be sorted out as well. But to jump over again and just put the onus on the individuals and have the state follow in tow is a very, very interesting way of trying to get, submission on the issue of, applying SORNA straight across the United States, which is the mission of the federal regulation. So, we've got to see just exactly where this all lands.
All right. Thank you, Chance. Looks like we have a question or a comment from Underdog. Please go ahead.
Hi. Hello. I have a few sort of questions.
Okay.
Do we know yet if, say, if a California registrant is someday relieved from registration, do they still have the IML reporting guidelines?
Okay, let me answer that question first. I know you said you have a couple of questions. In my communications with the Department of Homeland Security in the last 12 months, since the petitioning process began and people started getting removed from the registry, this is what they told me in writing. Number one, if you're no longer required to register in any jurisdiction, listen to that, in any jurisdiction, then no, you do not have to give the 21-day notice, number one. And number two, you don't have to have a unique identifier added to your passport. So they were very clear on those two points. The point they were not clear about, and they suggested actually that they would, go ahead and notify any country to which you're traveling, even if you're no longer required to register, which of course begs the question, how do they know you're traveling if you don't give a 21-day notice? Well, according to what I've read, unfortunately, the federal government is still reviewing flight manifests for every flight that originates from the United States overseas. They're looking on those flight manifests to see if there's anybody who's ever been required to register as a sex offender. Every single flight manifest. I don't know how they do that. I can only imagine how big an army they have of people who are doing that. But that's the only thing that makes sense is, again, if you're not giving a 21-day notice, how would they know that you're traveling overseas? And so supposedly they're going to send a notice to the country to which you're traveling. And what we don't know, because I don't think it's been tested yet, is whether or not that country will allow you to enter. Chance, do you want to add something there?
Yeah, I mean, we learned during the IML litigation, at least from the U.S. attorney that was handling it, that they were most concerned about those who had a pattern of going to countries where there's sex traveling. And so let's just say you've been relieved of the duty to register, but you're going to typical countries where sex trafficking is apparent, because they're only looking at apparency. Okay. Because the fact is almost every country around the globe has the same thing. It's just that certain countries are being held out outstanding for it, like, say, Mexico or, say, certain countries in Asia and so forth. If they see a pattern of going to those particular countries, even if it's innocuous, they're gonna probably send out a notice whether you register or not. My understanding from the SMART office last time I spoke to them in Washington was, in general, they're not concerned with anybody who's now off the registry, and they're not interested in sending out notices. But then again, and this is the point that Janice is making, they feel they have the authority under IML to notice even people who have been relieved. And if they see a pattern, I think that's exactly what they're going to do.
Andrek, I think you said you had more than one question.
Yes, thank you. So it appears that would apply to even SORNA regulated states and registrants that live there. They still may have the notice. The DOJ would still notify other countries of their arrival, from what you said.
Well, it's not DOJ that's notifying the other countries. It's Homeland Security.
Oh, Homeland, okay. Other question is, it appears that on a federal regulation level that CP or illegal images may fall into a tier 3, if not a tier 1. Is that safe to say, assume, of SORNA regulated states?
I think I know where you're going here. So, but let me give some background information so other people know what we're talking about. The federal government has done equivalencies, and they've looked at state sex offense laws, and they've compared them to federal sex offense laws. And they've said, well, this is the equivalent. We know it's, you know, in your state, for example, the CP, a federal CP, a felony CP offense, rather, is a tier 3 offense. Under the federal system, it's not a tier 3 offense. I believe possession of CP, even if it's a felony, under the federal system is only tier one. That's possession of child pornography under the federal system is tier one. In California, felony possession of child pornography is the highest tier, tier three. But this is where you're not helped if you live in California, because the SORNA regulations are, in fact, the floor, the least amount of restrictions, according to the federal government. And they say states, you can basically add any other requirements you want to. So unfortunately, that doesn't help anybody in California, because in California, a felony CP offense is a tier three offense. And the federal law is not going to change that. Anything you want to add there, Chance?
No, I think that's comprehensive.
Okay. All right. Does anybody else have any questions about these SORNA regulations before we move on? I don't see any hands up. Okay, very good. So let's move on. I will say, what am I going to say? We do have, we have a conference that's coming up on October 1st. So we'll have a Saturday in October, the very first Saturday in October. Well, it will not be the Chance and Janice show. It will be our annual conference. And so we will have a whole day full of speakers, and you will, in fact, meet many of our board members on that day. But in addition to that, one of the people who is a speaker who made making a presentation is, in fact, the lead attorney here on the SORNA case. His name is Caleb Kruckenberg. And Caleb is an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, which is a different nonprofit organization. It's been around even longer than we have, actually much longer. They've been around for about 50 years. I'm looking forward to the day when we can say that, Chance, 50 years. And they have more than 40 attorneys on their staff. So so Caleb is going to be speaking, again, this is October 1. Hopefully by then there will have been a hearing on the preliminary injunction motion. Oh, my goodness. I thought it would be long over before he was speaking, but he's going to be one of the speakers. Chance, you're speaking. I'm speaking. We have a board member named Catherine Carpenter, who's a law professor in Los Angeles. She has a new law review article, and we have a description of that article, as well as the article itself on the website. It's a fabulous, fabulous lawsuit, and it really is giving me some new ammunition in my cases. Something about the irrebuttable presumption doctrine. So I won't really go into that, other than it is a way in the past that many cases have been won, not when it comes to people on the registry, but in other types of cases, where we attorneys that are challenging laws can say, hey, you know what, you government, you're saying that this is that this person's a threat to public safety. Now you need to prove it. It really can shift the burden of proof, because right now it's even like in these petition cases, Chance, right? You go in and you say, this person, you know, is a law-abiding citizen. This person hasn't been convicted of a sex offense for over 30 years, you know, is registered on time for 30 years, blah, blah, blah. And yet the DA still objects to the petition. So I just got another rejection, an objection on Friday from one of my clients. And, you know, all I can say is, well, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. We're going to have a great conference. We're going to be talking about the petitioning process and many other topics during the conference. It's easy to sign up for the conference. We don't register anybody for anything, by the way, so I'm not going to use the R word. But if you want to sign up for the conference, you can go to our website, okay? And we're only charging $25 for that. It's a virtual conference. And I hope to heck that next year, in the year 2023, that we all feel safe enough to meet in person, because I miss your faces. I miss seeing you in the hallways and having some, you know, this is social conversation right in the hallway at our conferences. So we'll get there, but we want to make sure that you stay safe. Chance, do you want anything about the conference?
No, other than just, you know, please attend. It's going to be an interesting conference. I think that you'll enjoy it. And there will be, there will be some different things as you're discussed. So, you know, don't think it's all the same, because it's not going to be, I guarantee it.
Yeah, we're going to mix it up. Just like we're mixing up this meeting by having a guest speaker. Okay, so let's talk briefly about travel, domestic and travel, international travel. Chance, how about if you start that discussion?
Okay, well, I'm happy to do that. you know, let's talk about domestic travel first, and then we'll get into international travel. I think the name of the game in domestic travel, and we've already spoken about it a little bit, but the name of the game is that if you register in one place, in one state, you don't want to register anywhere else. And this is a really important thing. And the reason why you don't is because you don't want to complicate your life if there's a possibility that you can uncomplicate it, which means, let's take, for example, you live in California and you have a chance at relief here. Say you're on tier one or tier two, and even tier three, if you're there, or if you're a tier two and you're up in tier three because of risk, you know, there's still a potential for relief in this state. And so what you don't want to do is you don't want to travel and register in somewhere like Florida where you're going to remain on the registry for life. And, you know, of course, that dynamic changes all the time. So, but you don't want to go anywhere where it's going to complicate your life, because if you can get a remedy, say in California, and be removed from the registry, you know, it uncomplicates your life and allows you to start, you know, living life again freely, you know, to a certain extent. And I just have to say that, to a certain extent. But better than before. And so the idea is when you travel domestically is to put together an agenda, an itinerary, so that you know each and every state that you're going to travel to, you know what their laws and regulations are, so that you don't get caught up having to register, because you want to comply with the state laws anywhere you go. And so let's say that you're going to a state, and that state has, well, let's just say you're in California, you're going to Las Vegas, and Las Vegas says you got to register if you're there for anywhere, you know, I don't know, 24 hours, maybe, I think. If you travel across state lines and the clock starts to tick, you don't want to be there for longer than it takes to where you're compelled to register. So you want to leave before that time, even if that means going back across state lines again, like the, I think, Bruce, or I forget who the person who brought up that first issue was, but you know, it's a coffee issue, which is go have a cup of coffee across state lines and come back and retoll the statute. Okay. It starts all over again, and be aware of any aggregates in any state that you're at. This causes you to want to take the time to plan, and you can start first with our resource on our website. You can look at it and, you know, see if your state or the states that you're interested in traveling are there. And don't rely on that, because that's a snapshot of the law at the time that it was put into that database. What you want to do is use that as a jumping board to go then to the state and see if there's been any changes. And if you're still confused about it, speak to an attorney or call the state and the place where you're going and find out what the requirements are firsthand, knowing already the foundational basics of the structure. So, you know, what I'm saying to you is plan and know where you're going and know how long you can stay there and know exactly what to do to make sure that you don't have to register in any one place other than your state where you're required to register. That's the foundational idea. Janice?
Yeah, thanks, Chance. And folks, one of the things you need to be aware of, there are some states where if you go and register there, they never take you off the registry. Okay, two of them are Florida and New York. If you ever register in Florida or you ever register in New York, they will not take you off their registry. So why is this important? Chance, you talked about it briefly before, and it bears repeating, that if you're on multiple registries, it causes multiple problems. Okay, stated in the positive, you want to be on as few registries as possible, because, for example, under the International Megan's Law, if your offense involved a minor and you are currently required to register in any state, they can put a unique identifier on your passport. Okay, any state. And so time and time again, I've heard from people who visited New York, who visited Florida, who visited some state, and even they're saying, but I'm not registered. I don't go there every year to register. It doesn't make any difference. They're keeping you on their registration logs. And so you are registered there, even if you never return to that state. And Chance and I have both heard of a case, and I've never read it, but according to case in Florida, or what people are saying about Florida, is even if you're dead, they don't take you off the Florida registry, and that there was a case that challenged it and they lost. So that basically the relatives of the deceased person could not get their loved one off the registry even after he died. So that's how ridiculous it can be. Michael, it looks like you have a question or comment, sir.
Yeah, I do. Okay, so that's the whole reason I'm traveling across country right now is the fact that I'm trying to get rid of property in Arizona. My question about it is they're going to require me to turn on utilities at the property over here and stuff like that. Am I going to have to worry about any of that with this sort of regulations and all that stuff?
I think your question is, if you own property in a state, are you required to register there? Is that your question?
Kind of, yes. Yeah, it's just because they want me to turn on utilities because I'm developing the property so that I can sell it.
The answer is no. Michael, the answer is no. You have to.
Okay.
So just so everybody knows, just because you own a property does not mean you have to register there. Okay, the registration is supposed to coincide with residence. Where do you reside? And it's all linked to this faulty notion that you pose a current danger, number one. And number two, then of course, the government needs to know where you are at all times. So just because you own a property, ownership in and of itself does not trigger registration. Okay. So, Chancellor, I believe we've just been talking about domestic travel. I would like to say one thing. Oh, we got a John here. John's got a question.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So my question regards travel in California. I live in the Bay Area, and if I want to go to Tahoe for a weekend or 5 days, do I have to notify anyone or register up there or anything?
It depends what side you're on. If you're on the California side of Tahoe or the Nevada.
In California.
Then no, you don't.
Well, you kind of yes and kind of no.
All right.
kind of yes and kind of no. Where do you live?
San Francisco.
And you're going to a different jurisdiction, right?
El Dorado County, South Lake.
That's correct. If you leave the jurisdiction that you're registered at, you know, you're going to have to register in that area if you stay in any one place for longer than 5 days. Let's say you break it up. Let's say you go to El Dorado and you stay in one place for 3 days in El Dorado, and then you move and you stay in another place for 2 days. Then you don't. But if you're going to stay in one place for 5 days, at least 5 days or longer, you do. So, you know, I understand it's a little convoluted, but it is the way California works. And, you know, a lot of people get that confused because they think that, you know, the whole state is the jurisdiction. It's not. The jurisdiction is where you reside. You have your local jurisdiction where you register, and then you're visiting another jurisdiction. And, you know, the name of the game is the same, 5 days or longer. So you got to break it up.
Is there a limit of total days per?
No, as long as you break it up, you know, and you know, you just have to break it. You can't stay in one place. You can't go to a hotel and stay there for longer than 5 days. You know, you know, 5 days is the limit, and I would stay there, you know, 4.5. I wouldn't push it to the limit. I would definitely break that up so that you're not in one place longer than 5 days.
And then I'd leave.
And wait, I want to chat. I want to clarify here, and I'm sure Chance means this. It's 5 business days. It's not 5 calendar days.
Correct.
Oh. Okay.
Correct.
I have to leave the county. Leave El Dorado County.
Yeah, because you don't register in the county that you're going to visit, no. And so that's why the law kicks in there. And it's kind of a crazy thing because, you know, you're registering within the state, but it is what it is.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, John. So one other benefit to planning your travel, and I heard Chance say that earlier, is because, you know, again, you want to avoid having to register in another jurisdiction. And here's an example. The state of Rhode Island, I believe, has the shortest trigger for registration, which is if you're there for more than 24 hours, you're supposed to register in Rhode Island. But fortunately, Rhode Island is a very small state, right? So if you look at the state of Rhode Island, you look at states, you know, around Rhode Island, those states have much longer registration periods. So if I were planning a trip to Rhode Island to go visit Aunt Sally for Thanksgiving, what I would do is get a hotel not in Rhode Island, right? So go visit Aunt Sally's house for Thanksgiving dinner and then take myself to, I think Massachusetts is nearby, you know, stay in a hotel in Massachusetts, for goodness sake. So, I mean, there's ways to work with the system, stay within the system, not get charged with failure to register. Because, of course, that's what we're talking about, folks. And that's what Chance and I are trying to help you safely navigate around failure to register. Because you can, in fact, be charged with and convicted of failure to register in a different state if you, in fact, don't meet the requirements. So I don't see any other questions at this time about domestic travel. So let's move on to international travel.
Just one thing before we do move on. I think I skipped it and I forgot to even mention it, which is if, you know, with respect to domestic travel, and let's just say in California, you know, if you're going to get hit with a failure to register, it's going to be based on the character of your conviction. So if it's a misdemeanor here, it's a misdemeanor failure to register. If it's a felony, it's a felony. But you've got to be wary of other states and other laws, not just California. So just keep that in mind. Okay. That's it. Just thought I'd mention that.
Okay. Thank you, Chance. Gives me time to have a sip of my Diet Coke here. Okay. So, so let's move on to overseas travel. And the good news is there are countries that will welcome people who want to come visit, even if you're required to register. And I'm happy to report that the country of my ancestry, Italy, is one of those countries. Okay, so there's 26 countries in Europe that welcome people on the registry. The four large ones are Italy, Spain, Germany, and France. Some pretty nice places to visit, right? And there's 22 smaller countries. So if you go to any of those countries, you go to visit. They don't care if you're required to register it or not. They don't care that the U.S. government sends them a notice that says, oh, my goodness, did you know this person is required to register in the United States of America for having, you know, he's been convicted of an offense involving a minor? And folks, I'm really, really bothered with that language, the notice that they send out, because, of course, every country that receives it, it's going to interpret it in their own way. So it says if you've been convicted of sex offense, pardon me, involving a minor, it's their definition of minor. And there's some countries out there where a minor is under 12, right? The age of consent is 12. So they read that and they go, oh, well, I guess this person had sex with a 10-year-old. That must mean, because that's what it would mean in my country. So that's part of the problem with the notices that are sent. They're not specific. So they're not specific about what the offense was. And they're also not specific with how long ago did it happen. There's no reference whatsoever that this person was convicted of a sex offense involving a minor 27 years ago. It doesn't say that. It just says this person was convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. And I think that that is misinformation, quite frankly, when they don't put it in context. But that's what's going on. And that's why some countries say, oh, no, 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 we don't want you visiting our country because, of course, you're going to be, you know, sexually abusing our women and children. So anyway, but there are, unfortunately, other places where other countries where registrants are not allowed to enter. And please do yourself a huge favor by doing the research and finding out what countries those are, so you don't spend your time and your money traveling there only to be turned away. And I have had so many very sad phone calls with people, many times in tears, talking about all the time and money they spent to get to a destination only to be stopped at the airport. They weren't even allowed out of the airport, even when they had family and or friends waiting for them at the airport. They were not allowed out of the airport. So please, please, please do your research ahead of time. There's a website out there called the Registrant Travel Action Group, or RTAG, and RTTAG, I believe, .org. They have a matrix there, and the person who runs it, Chance and I know him well, he basically reflects on the matrix, the experiences people have had when they've traveled overseas. And just to, you know, give you some advice, you won't even have to look at the matrix. Don't try to go to Asia. You're not going to get into Asia, okay, unless you go to Hong Kong. And it has some political uncertainties right now, so, but Do I think it's terrible that you can't go visit Japan and go to see the Royal Palace and pagodas and everything else? Yeah, I do. But why spend your time, why you spend your money to get there only to be kept in the airport and then return back to the United States at your own expense, by the way? And so some of these airports, as I understand, are not such nice places to be kept overnight, and they don't exactly give you any creature comforts, right? With a few exceptions, but general rule is they take your electronics away from you and put you in a hole for, and you know, until your next, the next flight. And that's where you're stuck. You want to add anything to that, Chance, before we call on this person?
And it's just, it's a drag to get stuck, especially when you're, you know, you're shoved into a holding area. So you don't want to do that.
Okay. So Rafael, I see your hand up. I'm asking you to unmute yourself.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for doing what you do. We all pretty much depend on your information and your work to feel better. I was just confused in a couple of things in the things that we talked about. In regards to the difference between a CP offender and a offender that does not have any CP classification, is there a difference when you visit in other countries? Because I took a flight to Mexico. I was about 3-4 years ago, and I wasn't too familiar with this at the time. I wasn't part of this organization, and I had no problems. I actually went by myself. I took a plane. I landed in Mexico. I went to Guadalajara. I went to Puerto Vallarta, came back, and nothing ever happened. Of course, I've been off the police radar for 35 years, and I thought I didn't have to bother with that. The other question that I had was in regards to local traveling, is if you have a hotel in, say, Las Vegas, and then you go for a couple of days to Las Vegas, Nevada, and then you go for a couple of days to the California side, but you kept your hotel reservations in Las Vegas because you're getting a pretty good deal on the package there. Does that mean that you didn't really change your residency because you stayed for the 5 days in Las Vegas, even though you can show that you were for a couple of days in California side? And last question is, in regards to the child CP, I'm not interested on that, but I noticed that there are still a lot of people that do those trapping programs when they pretend that they are a young child, and somebody responds to that, and they set a meeting, and they get arrested, and or my feeling was that CP convictions were based on if you download and you sell or share or any kind of CP. But nowadays, when you look at regular pornography, there are also all these little images of young people that shows up, which you always feel like is a temptation of entrapment. But if you never download or sell or share or any of that, are you still being subject to a CP conviction? And I just frequently face this question because a year ago, actually, I had a cancer.
Stop. Don't say anything more. Okay. Please don't say anything more. This is a recorded.
Yes, I understand.
Recorded meeting, and we don't, and there's no attorney-client privilege, so let's just stop you there. Chance, perhaps you are the criminal defense attorney, not I, talking about CP, CP possession, and the other CP offenses.
Well, I kind of got lost in all that, as I'm sure most of us did, but let me see if I can answer that. That was a three-part question. That was the longest freaking question I've ever heard ever on this planet during one of these meetings, but I'll try. I think your first question was, why didn't I get hassled in Mexico? And my answer is, if you're a registrant, you went to Mexico and you didn't get hassled, it may have been a while back that the database was down at the time they checked the manifest. And so you fell through the cracks, and that is why the 21-day notice came about. For a while there, people were being able to travel freely and were being able to do it without any consequences. And I think the federal government took notice, and a la the IML came out. Second question. And I think the second question has to do with, remind me, is it CP offenses in general?
No, CP at all. But the second question was, you go to Nevada and you stay in a
hotel. Oh, that's right.
For 5 days because you get a good deal. But then in order to circumvent.
No, I got it. I got lost in translation there. So, okay. The question is, look, if I keep my own place if I get a really good deal and I keep it, but I cross the state lines and I come back, does it matter? Probably. I mean, it gets you into a real attenuated case of, where was I, and have I actually staked my claim? Am I actually visiting for longer than I should have? I think the best policy is to totally withdraw and then re-enter. I mean, if you want to do it cleanly without having to be hassled, especially if you have an underlying conviction for a felony, I wouldn't take that chance because you got a good deal, because it's not worth it. Because if you do the cost benefit analysis, it would take possibly thousands of dollars, if not more, to defend yourself and prove you were not actually there, or whatever. Why even get into a prosecution where you have to do that? Avoid it altogether. Be clean, which means take advantage of a deal. Maybe get a deal and a deal for two separate dates. Maybe get a deal for 2 days and maybe get a deal for another 2 days, and revisit it. But don't get one deal and then leave and cross the state lines and come back to the same deal, because I think it's going to complicate things. So I would suggest being very clean about entry and reentry. And I think the last question, I'm not sure if there was a question in there, but it had to do about CP offenses. What exactly were you trying to say about that?
Chance, let me answer what I think the question was, because that's the one that I remember the most. Okay. So folks, possession of child pornography is a strict liability offense. Well, what does that mean? It basically means if you've got it on your computer, you're guilty, or your tablet, or your phone, you're guilty, even if you've never looked at it. So I know that I am extremely careful about when somebody sends me anything, an attachment to an email, I do not open it unless I know who the person is and I know that they've sent me a document. I will not open it. I've had attorneys send me documents and I haven't opened them because I wasn't expecting them. Okay. You have to be extremely careful. And one way that some people get in trouble is peer-to-peer sites. Okay. And LimeWire is one of them. Do not ever sign up for LimeWire. You will get in trouble, because the fact is you're opening up your computer to anybody can send you anything they want to send. And I don't know if the government's sending these things or not, whoever's sending it, but quite often people who participate in LimeWire, I won't even Google that term on my computer. Okay. They get such things sent to them that is illegal images. And they don't say, well, I never looked at it, or I looked at it once and then I erased it from my computer. Unfortunately, the computer gurus can reboot things and they can tell, they know what you've ever looked at on that computer or on that device. And it is a strict liability offense. Folks, you need to avoid it. And oh my God, do not participate in selling CP. Don't participate in creating CP. And this is how sensitive I think we all need to be. One person, he was a family member of a registrant, and he had taken a picture of his newborn male child being diapered, and the little baby's genitals were exposed. And I'm like, oh my God, please. Tell this person to stop sending that picture. I saw it wasn't electronic. And I said, no, somebody's going to think this is child pornography, an infant being diapered. I've gone into my I've gone into my family's scrapbooks and things like that and photo albums of my own children. I have destroyed every photo I took of them than when they weren't completely clothed. And you know what? It's really sad. It's really sad that we even have to think about that. But I figure with the work that I do that I have to be squeaky clean. You may choose a different path for yourself. But again, mere possession of child pornography, that's an unlawful image. Somebody under the age of 18, even if they did it themselves, right, and they were totally consenting, is illegal. And let me give you a quick example. This is a real case. It wasn't in California, but it went all the way up to their state Supreme Court, I believe, and it was upheld, where one girl decided to give a oral copulate a one of her fellow students. They were both minors, right? And for some reason, she thought it was a good idea to take a video of this happening. And she sent it to some of her girlfriends. All right, ha ha, this, look what I did to Fred or whatever, right? And you know what? Those girlfriends didn't remain her girlfriends. And one of them took that video to the school principal. And the school principal turned around and took it to law enforcement. And she got convicted, and the conviction was upheld all the way up to their state Supreme Court of creating and distributing child pornography. Think about it. She's a minor. She committed a sexual act. She took the video herself of her doing what she did. And then she sent that video to some other girls in her school that she thought were friends. And this is what happened. She's now on the sex offender registry in that state for life for creating and distributing child pornography. This is how ridiculous it is. Roger, you've been really kind and patient having your hand up. Would you like to say something about this or something else?
I had an issue. I had to go to Las Vegas for business, and I had to be there 3 days, and they've got the 48-hour rule. So if anyone is interested, I can. You contact me at my phone number there, and I will tell you about the only hotel I found within a little over an hour from Las Vegas that's on the California side. So I stayed 2 nights in Las Vegas, came back over, stayed a night in that little hotel in California, and drove straight back the next day. And that got me around that rule to be able to do my full 3 days.
I commend you, Roger. You did your homework. You figured it out. Good job. Underdog, you have a question about travel, sir?
Yes, regarding my passport. Last November, I applied for a new passport. And despite me even including a letter I wrote requesting the registrant mark to be on it, it still arrived without it.
Oh, my gosh.
So I would like to go out of the country at the end of this year or early next year. Is there a way to find out if my passport for any reason has been revoked in the meantime or without raising any eyebrows, so to speak?
They would tell you. You'll find out. But my concern for you is that it was when you'll find out, right? So let's just say you go ahead and get your tickets, you paid your money, you've done, made all your preparations for traveling overseas, and you get on the airplane and you're sitting in your seat and somebody comes and taps you on the shoulder and says, excuse me, but your passport's been revoked. It's a real live example. It happened to one of my clients at LAX airport. He was going to travel to Europe with his wife to one of those 26 countries that would allow him to enter, but he had to have a valid passport. And according to him, he'd not been notified ahead of time that his passport had been revoked. And that's when he found out on the airplane right before they took off. So you don't want that to happen. So Underdog, if you want to contact me separately, maybe I can look at your paperwork or something like that. I would be concerned for you, again, if you don't have the unique identifier added to your passport. And folks, I used to say something completely different. I would say in the past, congratulations, you have a passport that doesn't have a unique identifier. But when that happened to my client, and then, by the way, his wife was on the same flight with him. They were celebrating their 30th wedding anniversary. They had friends and family waiting for them overseas, and they never got there. Because part of the problem these days, too, by the way, is it takes longer to get a passport than it used to. I mean, when I lived in the D.C. area, we could get it done in 24 hours, but that's, I don't think that's possible under any circumstances, unless maybe you work for the White House or something. I'm not sure. But in general, it's not possible to get a passport in 24 hours. So as I said, my client his whole trip, and he was planning to be overseas for 3 weeks. He lost a lot of money because all his accommodations and stuff were paid for, and he couldn't get money back. Please don't do that to yourself. Okay, do we have any other questions about travel before we move on to the tiered registry? And right before we go there, two things. Chance, maybe this is a time you can do your commercial.
Well, which one?
The one about sending money to Axel.
Oh, okay, that one. Yeah, please. People, you're listening to this and you're hearing all these different issues, but the thing about it is that it takes money and it takes time to do these things. Many people who are involved in this effort take no money and they give all their time, and they do it, you know, based on your help, your donations, and your efforts in forwarding our cause. And so please, if you can, and as much as you can, even if it's a little, donate. Help us perpetuate the cause. Help us help you by keeping this thing going.
Yeah, thank you, Chance. And you're welcome. Really easy to make a donation. You can do it online on the Axel website. There's a donate button. You just press the donate button, and that way you can make a donation. And you can make a one-time donation, or you can make it a monthly donation. And I know several people who are on the call today are making monthly donations, and trust me, we're very grateful for those. And whatever amount it is that you can afford, we do have $5 donations, and we appreciate every donation, regardless of its size. So thank you. Okay, so before we go to tiered registry law, I do want to mention briefly a case that's pending right now. Remember I said we basically picked all those low-hanging fruit? Well, we're reached up to the middle of the tree right now. And one case had to do with whether or not a registrant can serve on a jury in California. So a registrant convicted of a felony sex offense. So for the longest time, it's not been possible. But at that point in time, you know what? Basically, registrants were in the same category as people convicted of murder and a lot of other serious and violent felonies. But that changed. So there was a Senate bill that was passed and became law in California that basically said that most people convicted of felonies could in fact serve on a jury. But guess what? At the last minute, an exception was added. So now the law says, except for a person convicted of a felony sex offense. So we challenged that. We lost at the trial court level, and we're now up at the appellate court level. The last brief in that case and that appeal was filed in April of this year, so about 4 months ago now, and we're still waiting for a decision. But folks, this is one of those situations where it makes no sense, right, that somebody is basically excluded from jury service only because they've been convicted of a felony sex offense. And I just know that in the past, you know, there were laws out there that said people who were African-Americans or people who were of Hispanic descent or whatever couldn't serve on a jury because, oh, my God, you know, once the door is closed in the jury room, of course, the person's going to attack, you know, any little white lady who's on the jury, which is a bunch of nonsense. But, hey, that kind of stuff happens. That kind of thinking happens. So, fortunately, a lot of those rules and laws have been repealed, but now we're facing this one. And by the way, it's particularly troubling to me as a lawyer that there's absolutely no word, not even one word in the legislative history about why it's a good idea to exclude registrants. Nothing at all. Before the exclusion of registrants, the Riverside County Sheriff's Association, I'm calling them out by name because they deserve it because of their stupidity. And they said, and this was just in general, we don't think that felons should be in a jury room with, no, we don't think that the good citizens of our Riverside County should be in a jury room with gangbangers. That's what they said, gangbangers. So this wasn't even people on the registry. So I'm sure that they felt even more strongly about it later. But this is the kind of, I call it nonsense, that in laws that are being passed, and they're really called the but-for laws. And one of them just passed recently. It was giving people with, you know, criminal histories an opportunity for relief and really privacy. It's kind of like in Europe, the right to privacy, the right to be forgotten, right? But in this particular situation, they said, oh yeah, but except somebody convicted of a sex offense. It just makes no sense. So anyway, let's go on, because the tiered registry is something that a lot of folks here in California care about. I think some people outside the state also care about it because they're wondering what our state's doing with it. Maybe they don't have a tiered registry themselves and wondering, you know, if it's a good idea or not. So Chance and I and a lot of other people and Roger, we lobbied very hard here in Sacramento to get a tiered registry law. We didn't get the kind of law, though, that we had requested. So we wanted a law that was based upon current risk. The law we got instead was, what were you convicted of? No matter when you were convicted of it, what were you convicted of? So it's really produced some uneven results, shall we say. You know, I think about Frank Lindsay. And for those of you who don't know who Frank Lindsay is, he was my plumber. He was a great plumber. Called on him whenever I had a plumbing issue. I had no idea he was on the registry for about the first 5 years that I knew him. And the only reason I found out he was on the registry is because he wrote a book about his experiences on the registry. And I innocently bought a copy of his book thinking it was about plumbing or surfing. I had no idea that he was on the registry. And this was about his experiences on the registry. So, and then, you know, when I read it, I was just really troubled. Because I thought what happened to him, that he was an outlier. And what I have found out over the last 12 years is, unfortunately, Frank is right in the middle of things, right? So what's happened to Frank has happened to many more people, including vigilante violence. So anyway, and I mentioned that because Frank Lindsay so far has not been able to take advantage of the tiered registry law, even though he was convicted in 1979. Think about it. 1979. I don't know what you were doing in 1979, but it was a long time ago. I don't remember what I was doing in 1979, at least not without some coaching. But the fact is that there's some people who are not eligible to petition for removal under the tiered registry law, if for no other reason that they haven't gotten a tier assignment yet. And that's Frank Lindsay's case. And again, he was convicted in 1979. This is only offense he's ever been convicted of his entire life. And yet the California DOJ has not assigned him a tier. So guess what? When I filed his petition for removal from the registry, it was bounced. It was denied because he didn't have a tier assignment. So anyway, we will refile that petition when he does have a tier assignment. And supposedly, California Department of Justice has a deadline coming up the end of this calendar year. So on December 31st of this calendar year, they should have everybody's tiers assigned. And you know what? I don't think they will. They're not good at meeting deadlines. And if they don't, guess what? We're going to sue them. We've already made that decision. So thank you, Roger. Thank you. So anyway, in the meantime, there are many people who are eligible for to petition for removal. There are many petitions that are being granted. I have some statistics here from the California Department of Justice, and they're dated August 1st of this year. And according to that agency, 2,798 petitions have been filed in basically a 12-month period. So let's just round it up to 3,000. And of that number, 1,306 have been assigned to Tier 1. So that's almost half, maybe 40%. And of the 1,306 petitions filed by people assigned to Tier 1, 665 of them have been granted. Okay. And only 10 have been denied. So that's a pretty good track record, right? 1,306 filed, 665 granted, 10 denied. And the rest of them, quite frankly, are pending. And I understand that this process, it depends on the county. Some counties take as little as 2 months to process a petition, and some 6 months. And unfortunately, I have one that's been 9 months, but that's an outlier. Okay, when it comes to Tier 2 offenses, 1,388 people have petitioned for removal, And of that number, 777 have been granted and 20 have been denied. So I look at that and I go, well, 10 tier one petitions were denied and 20 tier two petitions have been denied. That's interesting. Not sure if it's meaningful yet, but we'll see when we get along. And when it comes to tier three petitions, 37 tier three petitions have been filed and none of them have been granted or denied. And so, I guess they are waiting, or they're pending 37. And by the way, most people on tier three, assigned to tier three, that is, are not eligible to petition. The exception is if you're on tier three solely because you have a high risk assessment, then you are eligible to petition. So Chance, do you want to add anything before we take this next call?
Well, yeah, the word sad, because the numbers don't reflect, you know, the potential power of the remedy. So sad, because it seems to me that we have, 108,000 registrants in this state. Even if we say, well, we've got somewhere between 80 and 90,000 that, you know, let's just say that. And out of that group, this remedy encompasses quite a bit of it, which means that only a fraction are taking advantage of the remedy, which means that people either are unaware of it or are aware of it, but are afraid to approach it. So I don't know which one of those it is, but it's kind of sad news in that respect, because everybody who's eligible should be taking advantage of this remedy.
So I ask if there's anybody on the call today who thinks they're eligible and hasn't filed a petition or had a petition filed on their behalf. If you would be so kind as to speak today, Chance and I would really like to hear from you. We're trying to figure out why it is so few people have in fact filed petitions. And Rafael, I know you've been waiting, so sir, why don't you go ahead and ask a question? Or maybe that his hand was up from earlier. So I'm going to lower his hand. Rafael, if you have a question, please put your hand up again. We have a Stan Jensen who's put his hand up. Stan?
Hi, Janice. Good morning. My one offense was in 1981. I live in California, Riverside County, in fact. And it should have qualified as a level three. That was a minor just under 14. I received my tiered registry notice last year on my birthday, and they identified me as level two. I haven't filed a case because I'm almost sure that if I went in and they looked at the facts, they would say, well, the state made a mistake qualifying you as level two. You really should be level three. And I didn't want to waste the money, frankly, the time and the energy and the emotional strife. Am I correct in that, do you believe?
It depends.
Go ahead. Yeah, it depends. Go ahead, Janice. I'll comment.
Yeah. Remember the tier assignments are based upon the offense for which you were convicted. And when I heard the terminology that your offense was under the age of 14, I'm wondering if your conviction offense was 288 parentheses A.
Boy, it's been 25 years, Janice. I don't remember.
It's easy enough, Stan, that don't do it yourself, but you can have somebody else do it for you. A friend, a family member, Chance or I can do look you up. But my gut feeling is you were convicted of 288A, which is a tier two offense. And if you have spent 20 years on the registry and don't have any failures to register and you're not on parole, probation or supervised release for any other offense, you may very well be eligible.
Yeah. This is exactly the point we're trying to make. I think this hits the nail right on the head, is that the DOJ has already determined that you're tier two. Okay. And they go through pains to make those determinations. So in your description, yeah, I think Janice is probably correct. It's probably a 288A, which we fought so hard to work into the tiered system as a tier two. The problem is not everybody knows it, or it's too painful to go back and look at it, or you're worried that you could be wrong and wasting your time and money. Whatever it is, it's keeping you on the registry when in fact the most beneficial thing you can do is revisit it, because if you have a chance of getting off the registry, your life will change dramatically.
Cool.
Stan, please contact Chance or me, and, you know, we can give you a quick answer. I will just say in general, and this is not commenting specifically on what Stan just said, when somebody contacts me and says they have a tier one letter, my response is, and then we go through the other qualifying factors, my recommendation is go file your petition today. Okay. The law might change. Why do I say that? Because the law might change. And if somebody has a letter that says they've been assigned to tier one, that means they are eligible, again, considering some of these other things that we just mentioned, that it's time. And I'm sorry, Stan, that you waited. And if anybody else is listening to this, either live or the recording, please, please contact Chance, contact me, contact your public defender's office. Because the public defender's office in many counties will, in fact, tell you if indeed you are eligible. And we have another question here from Gary. Gary, can you unmute yourself, sir?
Yep, I just did.
Thank you.
Is the tier system only in California, or is that throughout the United States? I'm in Colorado.
There are several states that have tiers, but not all the tiers are the same. And so for you, if you were convicted in Colorado, you would really need to go talk to an attorney in Colorado. If you contact me during the week, I can probably refer you to a Colorado attorney, but I can't tell you what Colorado is. Sorry.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Folks, we fought long and hard for this tiered registry, and even though we didn't get everything that we asked for, we got a lot of what we asked for. We really did. And not only that, we got a foundation on which we can build. So Chance and I and others from the organization, we will be in the Sacramento in our state capitol lobbying next year, because we were told, give the tiered registry a couple of years here. Let's see what the experience is of people on the registry. And then we, the legislature, will be open to at least considering changing it. Because we as an organization have gone to the state capitol since day one. Remember, this passed in 2017. This law has been around for 5 years already, right? And we said, hey, there's some things that need to change. Like, why it makes no sense to put people convicted of felony CP on the highest tier. It's a non-contact, non-violent offense. That doesn't fit on tier three, where the violent rapes are. I mean, common sense just tells me that. But folks, common sense had nothing to do with it. It was a political compromise. So the author of the bill, bless his soul, because he did take us across the finish line. But the fact is, we didn't get everything that we asked for. It was a political compromise. And guess what? The good news about political compromises is it's easy to challenge them in court. Okay. So, or easier. It's not easy to challenge us in court because, it has to do with equal protection cases, and I'm not sure this is the right time and place to discuss it. It's a little too lawyerly, perhaps. So, Chance, why don't you talk about some of the folks that you've been able to get off the registry so far?
Well, you know, yes, I've been able to get people off who have won and sustained convictions, such as the one we were just talking about, little lascivious acts or the child 14 or under, who have gone to prison for 8 years or longer. I've been able to get removed people that have had TBD status. But that's rare. And, you know, most of the time, you know, if you haven't been determined by the DOJ, you're in a waiting line. Either you're going to wait to file, or if you file, you're going to wait for the process to happen. You're going to just be in limbo. I have been successful in getting people off the registry that had multiple convictions, many of them, in stemming out of one case. So, you know, across the board, there's been a lot of individual cases that I would never even think of in terms of the prior remedy, which the new remedy is taking care of. And the best thing to tell you about all that is that before this remedy, when I had discussions with district attorneys and judges, people were really ignorant, and you had to edify them about all these issues every single time. You had to rebuild the wheel wherever you went. What this has done has stirred up a discussion. And that discussion, believe it or not, is turning out to be pretty good across the lines in terms of what this is all about. It's, you know, it starts with the idea of conviction and gets into risk, and risk is where we want to go with this. And so I'm encouraged by that. And so I'm happy about the petitions that I've been involved with compiled, because it seems to be moving things and educating in areas I never thought possible. For instance, Orange County. Orange County is a place where I never thought this would happen. It's happening. So I feel encouraged.
And I want to add to that. Remember I said there's like this range of time that it takes a petition to get through. The fastest county right now, the fastest two counties, because I think they're having a race with each other, are Alameda up in Northern California and Ventura down in Southern California. Now, Alameda makes a little bit of sense to me because the current district attorney in Alameda was one of the people who, in fact, lobbied in support of a tiered registry law. Her name is Nancy O'Malley. She's only going to be there until January of next year, guys. Okay, so if you live in Alameda County and you're eligible to petition, please petition as soon as you can. And then Ventura, again, I've had really good experience with petitions there. They seem to just get them through very efficiently in about 2 months' time. But I will tell you, to my chagrin and dismay, Los Angeles County, at least parts of Los Angeles County, are doing a very bad job. And what happened in LA County is that they basically are sending these petitions to different courthouses around the county and to some courthouses that they weren't prepared for this. I think they're smart people in those courthouses, but they just weren't prepared. And so when they got the petitions, I'm just looking at it, and I think it's like a deer in a headlights rather, and asking, what do I do with this thing? So anyway, we've gotten over some hurdles there. I mean, one of them was so bad that I even called the city attorney and begged them to do something, or anyway, it was a total mess. And I even filed a writ of mandate, quite frankly, against the city because their law enforcement people would not make a determination regarding eligibility, which the law says you have to do it. And by the way, you have to do it within 60 days and they weren't doing it. So anyway, they got educated that way. I'd rather educate them with a phone call or a letter, but if you're going to really dig your heels in, you're going to get sued. Okay, so I know two people are waiting. Gregory is waiting, and then somebody whose phone number ends in the number 203, you had your hand up first. So it's 203, you have a question or a comment here about the petition process?
This is sort of related. Anyway, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of lawyers, just total crooks, who write to you and say that they can get you off the registry and stuff. And there's this one guy, I keep getting letters from him. I even saw him one time. I like to just call his name out. But he is such an awful lawyer. When I saw him, he had his shirt off. You know,
when he had his shirt open.
He was wearing a shirt, but it was completely open, you know, in the front. And, you know.
Were you at the beach?
No, he was in Covina, even worse. And he's like, oh, yeah, I can do this, you know. I was like saying, well, what's your track record here, you know? And he says, right here, look at the flyer. It's obviously, you never read the flyer. And anyway, he made up some stupid name like, okay, Alice, let's get the Alexander Project laws, you know, set up, you know, for him. And anyway, I left, but I keep getting letters from him, and they're real threatening letters. I'm sure he sends it to everybody, but you know, there's a flyer that says, oh, you're a monster, you're a predator and stuff like mm-hmm. this, and you don't want to be called this anymore, and you know, called so and so to help you get off the registry, I can guarantee you, blah, blah, blah. And I wanted to stop. I wanted to stop sending it to me. So I'm thinking about just writing him a letter. I was thinking about calling him, but then they'll probably give me the hard sell or something. But if I write him a letter, aren't they legally obligated to take me off the mailing list? That's
no.
my question.
No, but you know what? If you'll contact me during the week, I'd be happy to write a letter to that attorney. I think I know who it is. I'm sorry, folks. We have some snake oil salesmen in our profession. We truly do. They make promises that they can't possibly deliver on. And it makes, quite frankly, makes all of us look bad. So
also, it, just to add to what Janice is saying, nobody can guarantee you a result ever. That's just when you hear that right away, you know, that's a sham artist. That's a con man. And not only that, be weary of the person who wants to do this on an hourly billing. I'll tell you a horror story. Of now a potential client of mine who allowed this to happen. And before he got to hearing, the attorney wanted him to pay what he had billed for, which is basically filing 5 pages, and he wanted $25,000 for that. So I want you to know that if you pay an hourly billing, you're going to get exactly what you asked for. And that attorney was going to ask for a continuance until December because the volume of work was so voluminous that he needed the extra time. Can you imagine that? So be wary of sham, con artists, grifters, and so forth.
I second that, Chance. Absolutely. I'm sorry. Look, Gregory, you've had your hand up for a while. Please go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Mine is a misdemeanor. I'm in Apple Valley, California, and that's in San Bernardino County. In my case, my 10th year is next year, and I did hire my own attorney, and there was no probation involved. I did fight it for 6 years, by the way. But anyway, my question is, when I registered earlier this year, I mentioned that to the person at the police station, and she said there was see my attorney on your 10th year after you register, and from there I received a letter from the DOJ within a year. Now,
Gregory, just stop.
Sure.
Because I think it's important for everybody to know the facts here. You don't have to wait to your 10th year to get a tier assignment letter. Folks, tier assignment letters were supposed to be available on January 1st of 2021. We're a year and a half plus past that. Okay. So nobody, you might not have your tier assigned yet, Gregory, but the fact is your tier, everybody here, you can request your tier assignment letter at any time. And this is one of the things that makes me so upset with the California Department of Justice, because they speak utter nonsense sometimes. I mean, private attorneys too, but so do the government ones. So the government attorney, California DOJ, told me that in the beginning, they did not have enough money. That agency did not have enough money to mail tier assignment letters to you. Think about it. We're the fifth largest economy in the world, the state of California, and they're one of the state agencies, and they can't mail somewhere between 80,000-85,000 letters? That is so ridiculous. I even hate to utter the words. And it's quite frankly one of the reasons I'm ready to sue the bastards as soon as they miss their deadline. So anybody who doesn't have a tier assignment by January 1st of next year, you call me, because you could be a plaintiff in one of these lawsuits. They're just being ridiculous. The tier assignment letters, though, if anybody wonders where does a tier assignment letter come from, no, the stork doesn't deliver a tier assignment letter, and they don't deliver babies either, okay, in case you haven't figured that one out. But the tier assignment letters are in a government-only database that's called CSAR, C-S-A-R, the California Sex and Arson Registry Database. Chance and I and every other private attorney, we don't have access to this database. Only the government does. Okay. So California DOJ decided they couldn't afford the stamps to send you a letter. So what they did instead was electronically dump these tier assignment letters into the CSAR database. You should have a letter in the CSAR database, even if it says your tier has not yet been assigned. And you know what? I have told people, depends how well I know you, I have told people, call your registration office every week and ask for your tier assignment letter. Or has my tier been assigned yet? You know, I mean, because somebody needs to put pressure on the state agency. Why can't they now at least mail letters to people telling them that your tier has been assigned, right? Because you don't know. If you've gotten one tier assignment letter that says tier to be determined, when do you know when they've actually determined your tier? You don't, unless you keep bugging the registration office. And I kind of feel a little bit sorry for the registration offices, because I hope they're getting a lot of phone calls from people on the registry going, hey, do I have a tier assignment yet? Some of them will take a phone call like that. Some of them won't. But the fact is, I just want to correct the record here. Your tier assignment letters are in a government-only database, and you have the right to go to your registration office and demand it. Please be polite if you can. Okay, Gregory, I think you had more to say. I apologize.
Gregory? That was it.
Okay.
So I go back to where I annually register, correct?
You have to register, sure, if you haven't been taken off.
Well, I mean for that tier assignment letter.
Yeah. No, you don't go to court. You go to the registration office. Right. Here's this again. The tier assignment letters are not available in Sacramento at DOJ. They're only available at the registration office. You go to the place you register and you request your tier assignment letter.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes. And that's it. And again, thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
And that applies to everybody, not just Gregory. So the other thing that I want to say is Gregory said, I was convicted of misdemeanor. He's assuming that means he's going to be assigned to tier one, the lowest tier. Folks, I hope it's true for him. I don't know what he was convicted of, but this is the deal. Some misdemeanor offenses are assigned to tier three. We have a lawsuit pending about that. People convicted of Penal Code Section 288.2 are being assigned to Tier 3. That should be a Tier 1 offense. Some people convicted of 288.2 should not have to register at all. So we have a very important lawsuit that's pending on that specific issue. Because remember I said the legislature, they said, come to us in 2023 when you need changes to the law. Well, guess what? Chance and I and Roger, we're not that patient. So we're suing the state government in court to try to change different parts of the law. And one of the parts of the law we haven't sued yet, because this is going to be a really steep mountain to climb, is the assignment of felony CP offenders to have the highest tier three. And again, that's a nonviolent, non-contact offense. And you're being put in tier three with people who've committed one or more violent rapes. Makes no sense. That's because there's no logic underneath that. It all has to do with political compromise, okay? And so I'm looking forward to that lawsuit because I know several people who aren't tier three because they were convicted of a felony CP offense, and I can't wait to help get them off of tier three. And whether it's by court or by the legislature, we shall see. Okay, I've got Underdog, you've already asked a question. So Tracy Morgan, you had your hand up. Tracy, hello. I'm asking you to unmute yourself, Tracy.
I apologize if I'm probably going back into what you were talking about earlier, but I was kind of expecting a little bit more conversation regarding the SORNA hearing that keeps getting delayed.
Okay.
Can you discuss the strategy behind that? Because I've sent you a couple of emails that that were useful to you. And you know, regarding the cryptocurrency as well as
cryptocurrency.
Anyways, is this a political thing that they keep delaying for? And once it happens, disclose your strategy? That's the question I'm asking.
Well, thank you for that question. It's not really our strategy because a different organization has taken on this lawsuit, but Axol is a plaintiff in the lawsuit, okay? We are a plaintiff. So, and that means you are a plaintiff as well, okay? So the organization is a plaintiff and we represent you. So you all are plaintiffs in this lawsuit, okay? And the reason the Pacific Legal Foundation is willing to take up this case is not really because they warmly embrace people in the registry. I'm sorry to report that. What they care about is the following. They see this as a separation of powers issue. Okay. So in their three branches of government, right? You got the executive branch, the president. You got the legislative branch, the folks in the, you know, the Capitol. And then you got the courts, the judiciary. And so basically what this lawsuit is all about is that the U.S. Attorney General basically is doing something that Congress didn't give him the authority, did not authorize him to do. So it's a separation of powers issue. That's why they care about this. Pacific Legal Foundation, I had really never heard of them before they approached us and said, hey, we heard about these SORNA regulations. We think we want to file a lawsuit, you know, and then we helped them find an individual plaintiff. They interviewed several people, and I was present at those meetings, and until they found an individual plaintiff that they were comfortable with. And then they took us on, the whole organization and its members, which are all of you. And it was a really interesting meeting. And I don't mean to be political. I don't think this is a political statement with the following. And they said in the first meeting, they said, well, you know, our organization, we're basically libertarians. And is that okay with you that a basically libertarian organization would represent you and your cause in court? And my response was, the Republicans don't like us. The Democrats don't like us. If the libertarians want to help us, that's great. So, and I really mean it. You know, and if the Republicans or the Democrats came knocking on the door and were willing to commit resources to a lawsuit to help the cause, I would embrace them as well. So it's an interesting experience working with them. And I will tell you, I don't agree with every lawsuit that the Pacific Legal Foundation has filed. I just don't. But guess what? They have a great track record. And if you go look at their website, you'll see that they have filed 16 lawsuits. 16 of their cases have been reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court. 16. And of that 16, they've won 14 of them. Think about it. 14 out of 16, those are damn good odds. And they are willing to devote the resources to take our case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court if it comes to that. So they're committed, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Underdog, you've got your hand up here. Do you have a question, sir, about the tiered registry law?
Yes, ma'am. Regarding the tier three registrants for illegal images, I'm pretty optimistic someday that'll be reduced to at least tier two.
Good.
But for those who are in that tier three currently, is there a timeline or a date we can look forward to have hopes of that being changed, the tier?
Okay. My crystal ball is a little fuzzy today, Underdog. I'm sorry. But no, I don't mean to make a joke of it. It's really important. I just don't know when. We've already, since the bill passed, became law in 17, we've been to the state legislature several times already to try to make this happen, and it hasn't happened yet. And again, they told us, come back in 23, we'll be open then to listening to you. But maybe it's time to pass on a real life story too. So right after the bill passed, the tiered registry law became law, I went to meet with one of our allies. This was one of the other organizations that said, yeah, the tiered registry was a good idea. And I said, well, you know, there's a few things that need to be fixed here. There were some political compromises that were made. And I mentioned the CP offense. By the way, this person is a full-time lobbyist. By the way, he's about 6'5" and weighs about 300 pounds. This is a mental picture. He's sitting at his desk. I'm sitting on the other side of the desk. And when I brought this issue up, this is what he said. If you try that, we're going to crush you. That's what he said. If you try that, we're going to crush you. And he leaned forward in his desk. And literally, I thought, if that man comes across his desk and sits on top of me, I will die because he's so big, right? And fortunately, it was just a verbal threat. But I don't take threats well. In fact, they give me extra energy. And so I'm bound to determine to make him eat his words. So we're going to get this done, Underdog. I'm sorry. I can't tell you what year, but it's going to get done and get you at least down to tier two. And Chance, I think that this is a good opportunity for you to talk about the off ramp for tier three. Remember that we've brought to the legislature in the past.
Well, we're looking to see if we can't establish an off ramp. You know, this is part of our legislative efforts, which is we, you know, right now the registry in California, it's called a tiered registry, but in fact, it has two tiers. In fact, it's a lifetime registry because people still in tier three, with the exception of tier two folks up there in risk, are doing life. And what we'd like to do is have a real true tier registry, which means that there's even an off ramp off of the tier three level based on risk after a specific time to be determined. We don't know. We have a guess, but I mean, we've messed around with the idea of 25 years, 30 years, but the fact is that there needs to be an off ramp to make it a true tier as part of the tiered registry in California. So that's important. And one other thing I will add is that, you know, this whole idea of illegal images being up in tier three, there is an exception to that. And that is in California, at least, we have as a possession of illegal images, the fact that that conviction itself is a wobbler, which can be filed either as a felony or a misdemeanor. And it's one of those things that DOJ is recognizing as a dual function type of conviction, which is the felony remains up in tier three, but if it gets reduced to a misdemeanor, it's a tier one offense. And tier one offenses are good in terms of the tiered registry. So those folks who have been convicted and are up in tier three because they have a tier three illegal images offense possession, you should be thinking about and looking into getting a reduction because that will change you from tier three to tier one. Okay, that has been consistent since the beginning of this thing. One of the only things that I can really look at and say is consistent is that they are honoring those. So that's something everybody should know.
That's a really good point, Chance. So I'm going to repeat what I think I just heard Chance say, and Chance will correct me if I'm wrong. If you were convicted of Penal Code section is 311.11A, right, which is possession of child pornography by the state government in California, I believe that's a wobbler offense and that you can, in fact, apply for a reduction and get that felony reduced to a misdemeanor. And if you're successful in getting that reduced from a felony to a misdemeanor, and this is only CP possession, then, in fact, your tier will move from tier three, the highest tier, down to tier one, which is the lowest tier. Was that correct, Chance?
That is correct. Now, I noticed in chat someone saying that's not true, and I'm saying it is true. Okay, it is true. It doesn't happen all the time on your timeline. It doesn't happen sometimes because there are mistakes made. The DOJ makes mistakes just like everybody else. But it is a consistent thing that has been happening across the board, and I can say that because many of the cases I've handled are going just exactly that way. I'm not saying that it's a perfect system, and I'm not saying that it's going to happen each and every time on your timeline. But I'm saying, and I think Janice will back me up on this, that has been consistent. They are recognizing misdemeanor possessions as tier one offenses. Your experience, Janice?
I agree. And I have written some letters to the California Department of Justice about individuals convicted in federal court of a CP offense. And by the way, the feds don't have misdemeanors. Everything's a felony. And I have been able to convince them to change somebody's tier assignment from tier three to tier one. I still don't quite figure out what all their factors are because I haven't had 100% success. Part of me thinks they're using a dartboard, but that's the cynical part of me. But some people, they've said yes, and they have, in fact, reduced their tier from tier three to tier one. It's worth a chance, folks. It's worth looking into. I mentioned Chance. Chance is a criminal defense attorney. He does reductions. I don't do reductions. If you have a reduction question, please don't call me because I'll just refer you to Chance.
Okay. I will say this, and just for anyone who doubts this, I'm saying it because I'm watching it happen, but it doesn't always happen in real time. And I think that Janice will say the same thing. State convictions for CP are reducible. They're wobblers. And when they're misdemeanors, they are tier one offenses in the state of California. And that has been consistent, not exactly fast, sometimes misinterpreted, sometimes records can't be found or matched, but that has been consistent.
Yeah, thank you, Chance. Before I take this next call, I guess I want to go back to the issue of people who are being told their tiers have not yet been assigned, because there's some real categories. There's some big, broad categories where people who don't have a tier assignment yet seem to fall in one of these four categories. Number one, it's a federal offense. Okay, if you were convicted in federal court, sometimes the state government has some problems figuring out what tier you belong to. I'm not saying that that's the way it should be. If you were convicted in a military court, I swear they're even more clueless about what tier assignment you belong to. And the third category, maybe I only have three, is if it's an older offense. So with Frank Lindsay, he was convicted, remember, in 1979, and somebody today said they were convicted just a few years after that. I swear these older offenses, they don't know where to go to find the records. Now, I find that incredible with Frank Lindsay, because I was able to find Frank Lindsay's criminal records just by going to Orange County Superior Court, which is where he was convicted. Why can't California DOJ get the same records? I don't know. But anyway, or maybe it's because it's Frank Lindsay and he's been a plaintiff in so many lawsuits that they put him at the bottom of the pile. Eventually, I think even Frank Lindsay will get a tier assignment. I expect him to be on tier two, quite frankly, but we'll just have to wait and see. Okay, the person whose phone number ends in 203, sir, if you will go ahead. Did you have a question, sir?
Back to that thing about the 311 being reduced. I have a 311A, but I did prison time for it. So doesn't that eliminate me from being able to reduce my felony to misdemeanor?
It sure does, because once you do prison time on anything, it becomes a straight felony, and it's no longer a wobbler. It's a straight felony.
Okay. Well, I wanted to check.
Yeah, so that's a great question to ask, and you just ask a criminal defense attorney who knows what he's talking about. Okay, so not all 311s, Penal Code Section 311s, are wobblers. Please understand that message, but for some of them who are, it might be possible to get them reduced again from Tier 3 to Tier 1. And then Tier 1, the beauty of it is only takes 10 years of registration if you don't have any failures to register and other felony convictions, you know, that you might, in fact, be able to file your petition right away. Okay, well, I think that Yvonne has her hand up. Yvonne, would you unmute yourself, please? I see your hand up, Yvonne, but you're muted.
Okay. Oh, hi, I'm sorry about that.
No problem.
I did a bad thing. No, I didn't do a bad thing. Before I knew about Axol, I hired a lawyer, that same lawyer that leaves his shirt open that somebody mentioned, this horrible person, to get me off the registry. And he has told, or well, his assistant told me that they filed my petition the first week of March. And I keep trying to find out, you know, where it is. Is there any way I can find out without having to go through the attorney? Because they don't seem to like me calling them all the time.
Actually, Yvonne, I know that you live in Los Angeles County. And so I can tell you that it's quite possible that information is available online. And if you want to call me during the week, I can help guide you to the right place. But there's case file searches in LA Superior Court.
Okay, thank you. I don't trust this. And because I don't trust them, I'm thinking I might have to do it myself, petition myself, which I wished I had been able to do. But I just went ahead, let them file it. Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
And thanks, Roger, for speaking today. Thank you. Roger's been really helpful.
And Yvonne knows because she's also a board member. Okay. Fire Tablet. Somebody whose name is Fire Tablet. Sir, ma'am? Mm-hmm. Are you ready?
Can you hear me?
Now we can.
My name is Mark, and I'm in San Diego County, and I want to give you some information. I have a conviction under Welfare and Institution Code 6600, otherwise known as a name and a label I don't like, the SVP law. And ever since I was released in 2006, I've had to register every 90 days.
Yes, sir.
So I just want you to be aware there are people who have to register more than four times a year.
I understand that. Thank you. I did, when I talked about registration before, I did not mention that group of people. And that's anybody who has, in fact, been determined to be a sexually violent predator. That's what SVP stands for. They do register more than once a year. Then again, anybody who's homeless, which I did mention, but it bears repeating, anybody who's homeless registers every 30 days. But in general, at least 90% of the people on the registry register only once a year in California. I know it's different in other states. And by the way, also in California, registrants do not pay to register. And unfortunately, there are some folks in other states who are paying to register. And I just think that that is totally disgusting. But that's just my personal opinion. You have an opinion about that, Chance?
No. No opinion.
All right. All right, folks. Well, I really appreciate the fact that you've stuck here with us for a couple of hours, plus a few, about 2.5 hours. Thank you so much. It's a great way to spend a Saturday morning to share this information. I'm so grateful, too, for the people who joined us and who spoke up. I hope that you will follow through with Chance's request and make a donation to the organization. That's how we keep afloat, literally. So far, the fact is that I'm reading something in the chat room right now. I'll answer that in a minute. But please go to the website. You can make a donation very easily there with using the donate button. You can also mail a check to the organization. Our mailing address is 2110 K as in Kite Street, and that's in Sacramento, California, 95816. Again, 2110 K Street. 95816. That's in Sacramento. Thank you, everybody. Take care, and we'll see you next month. Bye-bye.
Thank you.